Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Bernie Robinson, and I am the interim president of ONA. I am also the Region 2 vice president with the Portfolio of Education. Welcome to our ONA's Bill 124 court decision town hall. I'm joined today on this call by Angela Priokannon, ONA's first vice president with the Portfolio of Professional Practice and Political Action, Don Armstrong, Region 1 Vice President, Portfolio of Human Rights and Equity, Karen Mackay-Eden, Region 3 Vice President, Portfolio of Labor Relations, Aaron Aris, Region 4 Vice President, Portfolio of Local Finance, and Ellen Warrington, Region 5 Vice President, Portfolio of Health and Safety. Also joining us tonight are our senior staff, Andrea Kay, our Chief Executive Officer, Stephen Lobsinger, our Chief Negotiator, Sharon Bazran, Chief Legal Officer and Legal Counsel, and Lawrence Walter, Executive Lead, Communications and Government Relations. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us tonight on this call to hear about the decision on ONA's Bill 124 Charter Court case, which was released on November 29, 2022. I encourage you to inform your bargaining unit members and colleagues that tonight's call is being recorded and will be posted on our website for those who are not able to listen in tonight. I'm going to take just a few minutes right now to review the agenda for the town hall. In a few moments, Angela, our first VP, will provide some details and run a short survey that you will be able to participate in. I'll be giving some opening comments after that, and then Sharon Bazran will introduce our legal team, who will provide an overview of the decision in ONA's court case on Bill 124. Stephen Lobsinger will then speak to us about our upcoming negotiations, and then after that, we will take your questions. So I'm going to turn it over to Angela to start.
Thanks, Bernie. So in the meantime, we're in the process of calling all ONA members to connect them to this town hall. It does take several minutes to contact this many people, so please give us until about 5:40, and this will allow everyone to be on the line before we begin. During the town hall, you can ask a question at any time by pressing star 3 on your telephone. You will be briefly taken out of the meeting to talk to an operator. They will ask for your name, your workplace, and your question, and then you will be returned to the meeting. If you have a technical issue or need to leave and come back later, you can do so by calling this number, 1-855-859-7245. Again, that number is 1-855-859-7245. This technology also allows us to ask you some questions, and you can respond by pressing a key on your telephone. So let's give this a try with our first question while we're waiting for everyone to be connected. So the question is, do you feel you and your colleagues have a willingness to take political action to protest if the government appeals the court's decision that Bill 124 is unconstitutional? Press 1 for yes. Press 2 for no. So the question again, you feel that you and your colleagues have a willingness to take political action to protest if the government appeals the court's decision that Bill 124 is unconstitutional? 1 for yes and 2 for no. So we're going to take a minute here for the results to tabulate on my screen. So please just give me a moment. And it looks like we have 4,358 people on the line. So, just waiting for another minute or two. So right now, 88% say yes and 12% say no. So thank you very much for taking part in this survey. And then the next poll question will come up. Given the current environment for nursing, do you intend on staying in nursing or to leave the profession? Press 1 for yes, stay in nursing. Press 2 for no, leave the profession. So again, first press yes if you're staying in nursing, or press 2 for no if you're leaving the profession, given the current environment in nursing. So, looks like 59% are staying and 41% are leaving. So now that we have a good group on the line, I think we can begin. So I'm going to pass it back over to Bernie.
Thanks, Angela. So what a wonderful turnout tonight. Over 4,000 for this section of the town hall. We will be doing another two regions at 7:30. So our fight against Bill 124 has been going on now for more than 3 years since the Ford government passed it in 2019. We knew from the beginning that this legislation was unfair. It targeted female-dominated professions, and it interfered with our right to collectively bargain. Immediately, when the Ford government rammed through this disaster of a bill, ONA began to put our charter challenge together to prove that Bill 124 is unconstitutional. Our amazing legal team put together a strong case of affidavits, case law, and thousands of pages of evidence, which was presented in court. We are thrilled to report that ONA and other public sector unions have won this landmark victory, striking down Bill 124 as a violation of the constitutional rights of public sector workers. Today, we are very pleased to provide you with a short summary of the legal decision. This decision comes after a long 3-year battle that has been fought in the courts, in our communities, in the streets. ONA members have been integral in this fight, and we will continue to be so until we achieve fairness and the justice that all our members deserve. I'm really pleased to host this town hall this evening with our Chief Legal Officer and Legal Counsel, Sharon Bazran. Our legal team, who will walk us through the court's decision and next steps, and I'm now passing it over to Sharon, who will introduce her legal team. Thank you.
Thank you, Bernie. So, yeah, I have the opportunity to introduce our legal team, which was Kate Hughes, Danielle Bisnar, and Jan Borroway. And tonight we're joined by Danielle and Jan. This case was argued in court from September 12th to 23rd. And I think the decision was actually released in legal terms, I would say lightning speed for the courts, about 2 months later on November 29th. Like every good lawyer does, we often rush to the outcome. And so if it's a decision that you happen to get your hands on, which is publicly available on websites such as CanLegal, paragraph 362 and 363 of an 80-page decision give you the sort of conclusion, which is the Ontario Superior Court declared that Bill 124 violated Section 2D of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and specifically our members' right to freedom of association, which includes the right to meaningfully collective bargaining. This legislation has been declared void and of no effect. So I'm really pleased to hand this over for the next 15 minutes to Danielle Bisnar and Jan Borroway, who will take you through this decision. So I'll hand it away. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon. Good evening, everyone. This is Danielle Bisnar from Cavaluzzo's. As Sharon indicated, I was one of the members of the legal team, and I'm here this evening with Jan Borroway, and we'll each take you through some of the elements of this decision. We were taking bets in terms of how long it would take to come out, and none of us expected it to come out within 2 weeks of the hearing. So I think it's a testament at the level and the level of detail and nuance in the decision, and it coming out at that speed is due to the judge's recognition of how fundamentally important these issues are and how long people have waited to have their rights adjudicated. So just to remind everyone, the Bill 124 charter challenge was a challenge to the somewhat dystopically named Protecting Sustainable Public Services for Future Generations Act. And the effect of this act was to limit compensation increases for 3 years for each bargaining unit to 1%, a total of 1%. And it applied to publicly funded healthcare settings and to over 90% of ONA's members. ONA made a number of arguments in this charter challenge in which it relied on the right to freedom of association, which is under Section 2D of the charter, and the right to equality on the basis of sex or gender, which is under Section 15 of the charter. So in terms of 2D, the freedom of association argument, this is the right under the charter that protects collective bargaining and protects the right to meaningful collective bargaining. So ONA argued that the 1% compensation cap in the legislation violated the rights of ONA members to freedom of association by substantially interfering with their right to meaningful collective bargaining. And it did this by taking this fundamental term of employment, compensation, off of the bargaining table. And that gutted ONA's bargaining power at a time when they otherwise would have had greater bargaining power due to the dire need for nurses in the healthcare sector due to long-standing shortages, and then compounding that, the effects of the COVID pandemic. So Justice Conan of the Superior Court overwhelmingly agreed with ONA's arguments and the arguments of the other unions as well on Section 2D, and he delivered nuanced, detailed reasons recognizing the many harms of Bill 124, including that the act restricted the union's ability to negotiate that key issue of how much members would be paid in wages, benefits, and other monetary compensation. Bill 124, he recognized, weakened unions' bargaining power and prevented unions from trading off higher wage increases to obtain other non-monetary benefits in bargaining. He found that the government used its legislative power to tilt the balance of power in favor of the government and employers, and gutted that bargaining power that usually accompanies labor shortages. He found that Bill 124 specifically prevented ONA from advancing the bargaining priorities that had been identified by its members, including appropriate staffing ratios and job security, because with only 1% available, there was no bargaining power to negotiate or trade off for those priorities. Justice Conan also found that the bill limited employees' ability to collectively identify and pursue their common goals and priorities, prevented unions and employers from negotiating solutions to address long-term chronic recruitment and retention crises in healthcare and the impact of short staffing on remaining workers. He found that another harm of Bill 124 was to interfere with and break apart long-standing bargaining relationships.
Oh, hi. It's Sharon here. I'm just wondering if other folks can hear me. I think we may have lost Danielle. Okay, I think we'll just take a minute to try to regain our audio, if we can just stand by. Oh, hello?
I can hear you, Sharon, now. It was quite silent for a while.
Okay, so it looks like Cavalusos is saying that they think their phone system went down, but maybe what I can do, they're going to, in the meantime, I think, Bernie, try to connect, but maybe what I can do is I can just step in and try to finish the wonderful summary that Danielle started. So what Danielle was last saying was, and please, if Danielle, Jane, you come on the line, please feel free to let me know. So what the other harm that the judge identified was, Danielle was speaking about the long-standing relationship between unions and their members, which is sort of a sacred relationship. And what the judge found is nurses were very disappointed following the release of the Hospital Central Award. And understandably, nurses were very frustrated, and other healthcare professionals were frustrated. And at the time, that the impact of Bill 124 affected the relationship between the union and their members. And as everyone knows, when really it was the government at fault. So that was something that, oh, hello?
I didn't want to interrupt you, but I am back on.
Oh no. Okay, good. I was actually hoping that you, I was actually inviting you to interrupt me earlier. So Danielle, I just finished speaking about the harm between ONA and its members. So if you'd like to finish up on that and proceed to what you were going to say next, please feel free.
Absolutely. Thank you. And my apologies, everyone. Yes, that's right. One of the key areas that that the judge noted was that it was not only the relationship between and the power imbalance between between ONA and employers that was harmed by Bill 124, but the internal relationship between ONA and its members because of the frustration that arose due to the government really straitjacketing ONA's ability to represent its members. So he recognized this wide range of harms that arose under Bill 124, and found that as a result of all of these harms that Bill 124 substantially interfered with the right to collective bargaining that is protected under Section 2D of the Charter. And on that basis, he found that the legislation is null and void and of no force and effect as of November 29th. ONA also brought separate arguments under Section 15 of the Charter, which were arguments grounded in gender equality. And under Section 15, ONA argued that Bill 124 discriminated against predominantly women healthcare workers who are doing what has historically and traditionally been viewed as women's work in the labor market. So nearly 80% of the workers covered by Bill 124 are women identifying, and they work in predominantly and historically female sectors, the largest of which are healthcare and education. So ONA argued that Bill 124 reinforced the historic undervaluing of women's work and reinforced the gender pay gap by suppressing wages for a predominantly female or women-identifying group of workers. And the court, while it did not uphold this argument, the evidence that ONA introduced under its Section 15 argument, in our analysis, had a significant impact on his Section 2D reasons, because he did accept all of ONA's evidence about the gendered nature of the labor market and of the healthcare sector and the historic devaluing of work traditionally associated with women, and his acceptance of this evidence informed his analysis of how Bill 124 interfered with collective bargaining by exacerbating that power imbalance between employers and workers. So that is one of the many ways in which ONA's evidence was critical to the court's findings. And I'm going to pass it off to Jan Borowy now to highlight some of the other ways in which the experiences of ONA's members was key to arguments that we were able to make and the court's findings on the harm of Bill 124.
Okay, I don't think we can hear Jan. So, Jan, are you there?
Yes, I am now. Our apologies.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Great. Sorry about this, Sharon. So, as Danielle said, I just wanted to highlight a couple of other pieces, and I don't want to repeat the summary that both Sharon and Danielle have been providing everyone. But our first area that we wanted to cover off was the extensive evidence from ONA that the judge accepted, because it was very, very important and clearly assisted in finding that Bill 124 really did breach owner-nurses' rights to collective bargaining. The second thing I want to talk about very, very briefly is some of the balancing that was done under what we call Section 1 of the Act. So first off, what are some of the key pieces of ONA's evidence he emphasized? Keep in mind that ONA filed multiple affidavits from the bargaining team, from frontline bargaining unit presidents, from the CEO, the president, from Steve Lobsinger, and amassed a huge record, including filing full and complete interest arbitration briefs. ONA's evidence was well over 60 volumes of detailed reports and statistical analysis. And in fact, I think ONA's record was the largest out of all of the union side applicants. So one of the first pieces of evidence that he absolutely accepted and played a key role in his definition and of finding this breach was the impact of Bill 124 and staffing. Now, of course, this is something that ONA was arguing all the way along, and it was so very important. And there, what he emphasized was that with the shortages caused by Bill 124, it created, it re-emphasized the serious issues around recruitment and retention across the entire healthcare sector, home care and hospitals and long-term care. He said that, look at these shortages, and this is literally at paragraph 93 of his decision, said these shortages mean that the existing staff must work harder on any given shift than they would ordinarily do, and now they're doing so for no extra pay. The short staffing takes a toll on the mental and physical health of employees. That means an increased physical workload, means more injuries when working with short staff. And you're really, when working on the front line, staff are just too busy. And their the actual mental and physical health, particularly of residents in long-term care and patients in hospitals, deteriorates. He talked about quite explicitly, and this was something that ONA put into evidence, that when you're so stressed out as frontline nurses, you're facing a stark emotional choice. You know, are you going to take care of your patient, or you're running around like a chicken with your head cut off? And he says, look, if you've got to work with someone who's dying, you're quite frankly going to be that last person a dying patient receives comfort from in the form of another human being, just as their lives end. And he said, look, employees live this day in, day out. They break down in tears. He recognized how exhausted nurses and other healthcare workers are and that they're burning out in what he called as existing in healthcare, a vicious cycle of short staffing. So in this regard, he completely accepted ONA's evidence. And it's very, very important. I think as Sharon and Danielle mentioned, and I won't emphasize this again, he did talk about the impact that Bill 124 has on salary, trading salary increases versus other issues. So other bargaining priorities, such as the adjustment of full-time and part-time staffing ratios or improvements in job security, he said just couldn't be done. Excuse me. He also importantly recognized that that really interest arbitrators have woven into the criteria of the HILDA, which the majority of ONA members are covered by, which is the Hospital Labor Disputes Arbitration Act. They have woven in there a criteria that they have to think about the issue of retaining and recruiting qualified employees. He said one of the impacts that has happened is that traditionally in the time of labor shortages and short staffing, that would translate into increased wages. That couldn't be done. You couldn't do the appropriate bargaining that you otherwise would have. The other key factors are that he found that the Treasury Board Secretariat under Bill 124 given itself a right to override collective agreements. And in ONA's case, they overrode six collective agreements. And that was, again, a breach. And Sharon's mentioned, as well as Danielle, the impact on the relationship of the union to the members and how that was split apart and significantly interfered with. Also, Ona's evidence was heard. Ona's evidence had a profound positive influence on the decision. And if you have a time, if you have a moment, which I'm sure you don't, but there are some 80 plus pages it's worth reading. Our next, area that we wanted to discuss with you was what was called Section 1. So any constitutional challenge which involves the Charter involves a weighing and a balancing. This is of rights versus what the government can do in a free and democratic society, and this is called Section 1. So the rights in Canada under the Charter are not absolute. The Section 1 allows for reasonable limits that are prescribed by law that can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. And that's Section 1 of the Charter. Ultimately, what Justice Conan found was that, in fact, the government could not justify Bill 124 on any of the grounds. There's a number of tests that are applied when conducting this balancing, and there's just three areas I want to mention to you and highlight. Number one is that he found that the government actually had not justified the economics behind and the alleged economic justification for Bill 124. And he particularly turned to the evidence of the union's economic expert, Sheila Block, on noting that the government had eliminated $1 billion per year of revenue from vehicle license plate stickers. But in the meantime, the total cost of the 1% cap was $400 million a year. He said, Ontario never explained why it was necessary to infringe on constitutional rights to impose wage restraints at a time it was providing tax cuts and license plate stickers to the population at large, which in fact were 10 times larger than the savings from Bill 124. He said just simply that just wasn't explained. The next element that he examined was trying to sort out whether or not there was in the test under Section 1 a rational connection between the objectives of Bill 124 of wage restraint and of the objectives with long-term care. And he actually did spend some time examining the funding within long-term care and said it just simply could not be justified, and that in fact Ontario had not explained why it could not freeze or limit any increases to the daily patient fee in long-term care homes, and just simply had not explained why it seemed to be more politically convenient to infringe charter rights than refusing to do something and refusing to provide additional funding to long-term care. The third element that he really emphasized was the extent to which bargaining, that simply the government could have sat down and just bargained with the unions. They certainly could have done so under Bill 124, but instead tied the hands of interest arbitrators, put them into straitjackets, and that simply wasn't explained as a reasonable limit in terms of analyzing charter rights. So ultimately, what we find is he concludes that he says it might be appropriate to infringe on a charter right when faced with serious fiscal challenges, but it's not appropriate to do so as part of the day-to-day management of government affairs. So in other words, what he's concluding is that, yes, there might have been election promises to cut taxes, but that doesn't give the government the right to breach charter rights. And so it's a very, very strongly worded decision. And as he concludes, as we said at the top, that Bill 124 is void and of no effect. So what I'd like to do now is pass the phone back to Danielle.
Thank you, Jan. So I just want to conclude by making a couple comments in terms of next steps for the charter challenge. Some of you may have heard in the media
that Ontario and Premier Ford has announced their intention to appeal the decision of Justice Conin. We, to date, as far as we are concerned, this intent to appeal has been announced on Twitter and in the media, but we have not yet received notice through counsel. The Crown does have until December 29th to file its notice of appeal, following which that appeal process would be underway should they in fact file an appeal. But as of right now, it is not official and has only been announced in the media. And finally, before I turn it back to Sharon, Jan and I would like to close by saying a few words and paying tribute to Kate Hughes, who, as you heard earlier from Sharon, and many of you will have seen on Zoom if you were able to watch some of the hearing, was counsel on this file. And she is unable to be here tonight. She sends her regrets, her greetings, and congratulations. The reason that she is not here is because she is embarking on retirement after 35 years of advocating for nurses, during which she advanced nurses' working conditions, human rights, in a range of forums, from grievance arbitration to the courts and the College of Nurses, interest arbitration, and in inquiries. She was a fierce and skilled advocate, a generous feminist mentor within our firm and the legal profession broadly, and a passionate fighter for workers who devoted the bulk of her career to advocating for nurses. So we just wanted to take a moment to honor her. And I will now pass it back to Sharon.
Great. Thank you very much for the presentation. And I think we have some more information to hear from. So I'm actually going to pass the baton to Bernie. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon, Danielle, and Jan. Very valuable information for us. Before I move on, I'd like to remind you that you can ask questions by pressing *3 to get into the queue. So now I'd like to call on Steve Lobsinger, ONA's chief negotiator, to talk about the next steps in bargaining.
Good evening, everyone. Just my own thank you to the legal team for the good work they did with this case. It's amazing. I'm not sure what I felt about whether we were going to be successful or not, but I'm happy we were. We can now go back to the table and do what we should have done or been able to do in the first place. But I just wanted to provide you some information about next steps for ONA with regard to negotiations and bargaining. Be sort of high level because with the court decision only coming down last week, we've got a lot of ducks to get in a row, I guess. But since the decision has no effect, or if the decision of the court means Bill 124 has no effect, we will be able to go back and renegotiate other issues related to compensation, not limited to the 1% wage cap and the the small bits that you got applied to premium payments or whatever the case may have been. We've had some preliminary discussions with lead negotiators from the OHA representing the participating hospitals and Bob Bass, representing the participating nursing homes, as well as Dan McPherson representing home care coordination and support services. What exactly the plan looks like for these negotiations is still to be determined. The OHA needs to go back to their board to get a new mandate for bargaining. Once that's in place, we should be able to proceed. Toward the end of last week, notice was provided to arbitrators Stout, Gedeloff, and Goodfellow that ONA intended to seek to reopen activate the reopening clauses in the arbitration decisions for the participating hospitals, participating nursing homes, and Monchong for the aged. This week, we'll be sending more notices to other arbitrators who'd set down decisions that were constrained by Bill 124 and also contain reopening provisions. So what this means is if we go back at the central level and can't settle the issues related to compensation back to 2019, we have the right to go back in front of the arbitrator and argue our case, and they are not constrained by the legislation, so they can make their decisions as they normally would have. For those bargaining units that don't take part in central bargaining, like the charitable homes and some non-participating nursing homes, non-participating hospitals, the health professionals groups, there have been settlements as well in those bargaining units that have reopener clauses. So we will be serving notice of our intent to renegotiate on those employers directly. I expect we'll proceed first with the participating hospitals, as we normally do in our pattern of bargaining, and then proceed from there to the central homes. For home care coordination and support services, we had commenced bargaining with four of them in the province, that being Central East, Central, and H&HB in Waterloo-Wellington. And we're to the point of heading for the conciliation, knowing that when 124 applied, that we had to argue about something different at conciliation, and that was where to put the extra money out of the 1%. But now that the award has come down, we've basically hit the reset button and told the we put the employer on notice that we intend to go back to the beginning and start again with normative proposals and do bargaining in the normal manner. What that means for them and for the members and for ONA is that under 124, we were unlikely to have a strike if we can't come to agreement. But what it means now is that bargaining is as it normally would, and the members who had the right to strike will have the right to strike going forward. I think that's all I have, Bernie.
Great. Thank you, Steve. We do have a few questions in the queue now. And if you would like to ask the question again, press 3 to get into the queue, and you'll be able to ask your question. So we have a question from Sanja Kekic, Joseph Brandt Hospital. Why is ONA not publicly challenging the fact that Ford and Jones are openly lying? For example, their claims that so many nurses have been licensed by the college versus the real number of nurses currently practicing. So from personally, I can tell you that I have been doing many, many, many media calls, not only calls, but videos and interviews with a number of media stations. And we have been actually providing the appropriate facts to the public. We have also been speaking out at the Ontario Health Coalition town halls. And we have been trying to set the record straight. So we cannot make the media stations publish anything that we have spoken on, but we have definitely been out there, and our communications team certainly has record of all of the media bites that we have had. So I hope that answers your question. Joan McCollum, how will the reopening clause impact 2023's round of bargaining? Steve?
It's yet to be determined, Joan. Truly, I would like to know the outcome of our renegotiations on the Bill 124 issues so that we have a starting point for the next round. But if we're not there, then we will be proceeding in this 23 round as we normally would. I mean, regardless, even if 124 was still in effect, the moderation period was over. So we're into normative bargaining. It may take some backwards calculations of percentage increases, but we'll figure it out. But I'm hoping that we can get something settled with the hospitals prior to going into bargaining.
Thank you, Steve. Our next question is from Emily Gordon and Grand River Hospital. And she is asking, will we be looking at negotiating retroactive pay, and will that be from the date Bill 124 was enforced?
That sounds
Steve,
like
I'm not sure.
I see there's others about retro in there. So the answer to the retro questions, yes, we will be seeking retroactive pay back to the date that 124 first affected your collective agreement. So for the central hospitals, that'd be April 1st, 2019 was the first date that was restricted. So we'd be looking back to there. So it's whatever year you got your first 1%, that's as far back as we're going. So we're not restricted. And so for the hospitals, there's two different arbitrators involved because there was the one-year collective agreement and then the two-year collective agreement that we'll be looking at.
Thanks, Steve. So we have a question from Gitti Safi Fakur from Humber River Hospital. When did ONA launch its charter challenge, and which other unions were also part of the challenge? Do I have one of our legal team answer that, maybe?
Thanks, Bernie. I can take this one. So Bill 124 was passed on November 7th of 2019, and ONA filed its charter challenge about a month, I think less than a month later, in December of 2019. And through early 2020, a number of other unions, as well as a coalition of the Ontario Federation of Labour, which I think included about 30 unions within that coalition, all filed separate applications. So in total, there were 11 applications from different unions and groups of unions. So that included SEIU, Unifor, OPSU, a number of unions in the power sector and in the university sector as well.
Great. Thank you very much. We have a question from Joanne. From the appeal ruling that happened in Manitoba, what has ONA's leadership learned from that, and how are they going to apply what they learned in our case now? So one of our legal team.
Sure. Thanks, Bernie. Hi, everyone. It's Jan. So I think it's really important to know that decision at the Manitoba Court of Appeal was in fact before Justice Conan in our Bill 124 arguments. So just for everybody's benefit, in Manitoba, the government introduced wage restraint. It was found to be unconstitutional at the first court level, just as Ontario's Bill 124 was found. Now, what was interesting was that it was found also to be unconstitutional for a group of faculty associations that were striking at the time. Now, the government appealed, and they won on appeal. But that Manitoba Court of Appeal decision, as I say, was before our judge, and we distinguished it. We said, look at that, we don't think that judge got the test correct. But more importantly and most significantly, when one looks at constitutional challenges such as this one against 124, you really look at the facts, you look at the context. And so while the government said, the Ontario government said, don't worry about things, this is just a time-limited bill, we argued, all of the union side council said, it's not time-limited. It is, these moderation periods are, yes, sure enough, 3 years, but they go on and have of negative effect down the road because you can't catch up your wages. And that actually means it's not a time-limited piece of legislation. So this question, Joanne, is a very, very important one. And I think it's significant that the judge considered that Manitoba Court of Appeal decision, and yet still made the important finding that Bill 124 was unconstitutional.
Thanks, Jan. So another question from Diego Marquez Leon from Leisure World Caregiving Center. If there is a possible appeal from the government, how will that affect the negotiations, but also the starting of the reopening of collective agreements that were agreed upon under Bill 124 and the arbitrated decisions? Dave?
I'm happy, this is Danielle, I'm happy to start on this one, and if Steve has any comments.
Yeah, you can talk about the effects of an appeal, and then we can talk about the rest.
Sounds good. So the important thing to note about the November 29th decision is that it took effect immediately. So as of that date, the bill is of no force and effect. If the government does appeal, one option that is available to it is that it can seek a stay of the decision. And that is something that it would have to prove to the court that it would ask for the decision to be paused and for Bill 124 to remain in effect and the collective agreements under Bill 124 to remain valid while the appeal was proceeding. But in order to get a stay, it needs to demonstrate that if the stay is not granted, there would be irreparable harm to the government, which it will have difficulty doing because the courts generally do not consider monetary matters that can be remedied by payments at a later date to be irreparable harm. And the other element of that is that since, as Steve described, ONA has been starting those negotiations with employers under the reopener clauses that are in place, the more advanced those negotiations are, the more that ONA will be able to demonstrate that there would be harm to it in granting the stay, and that another element of the test, which is the balance of convenience, would also favor ONA. So that is something that the government may do, but it would have to meet a high legal test in order to get a stay.
So I think then, as Danielle said, until there is a stay, our position is it's, you know, go forward, carry on as we've planned. The only thing that can stop us is a stay or them being successful in an appeal. So we're going to stay the course and just keep pushing this.
Great. Thanks, Steve. So Colleen McPherson from Lake Ridge Health asks, as we were not successful with Section 15 of our challenge, what steps will we be taking? My screen just went black. Just one second, please. What steps will we be taking towards achieving parity with our male counterparts in police and fire? It feels like our salaries are being penalized by the provincial and municipal funding models.
So, hi, it's Jan. I think Colleen's question has both a legal aspect to it as well as Steve's collective bargaining aspect.
Yeah.
So, from our analysis of Section 15, what was interesting is that the court actually accepted our evidence to say that the bottom line was that, yes, these are female-dominated positions, and that that there fundamentally there were issues around largely a gender pay gap. However, the court said, "Look, you haven't made the complete analysis under Section 15." But what the court did, and what Danielle emphasized earlier, is identify how important collective bargaining is for female-dominated, women-dominated professions such as nursing. And so I think, frankly, in light of that, in light of access under interest arbitration, it is so important to continue to put the evidence in front of interest arbitrators regarding the current provincial and funding models, how the male comparators, male-dominated professions, such as police and fire, are advancing in ways in which the nurses have. And I do want to emphasize that part of our, certainly part of the evidence that we had before this justice was that police and fire have been advancing in ways in which nurses haven't. So Steve, perhaps over to you on and I guess one other final point I would just make is that, you know, I think that this the option and the doors are open now with respect to trying to push this farther through collective bargaining. So Steve, I'll put this over to you now.
Yeah, thanks, Jan. Hi, Colleen. We will be looking at those issues. We did try to address that with Arbitrator Gedilov in the last arbitration. So with the elected team coming in January to get ready for this round of bargaining, we'll be looking at that for sure.
Thank you. Christine Smith from Guelph General Hospital is asking, if we get retroactive pay, will nurses who already left but who were working during the time period that Bill 124 was in effect be entitled to that pay? Steve?
Generally speaking, retro goes to people who have left, and we would seek that in our negotiations. And there's never any guarantees that we have to go to an arbitrator, but we would certainly have that on the table.
Great. Thanks, Steve. We have a question from Dale Sogtrup. When do we expect our home care sector to be back at the bargaining table? With Bill 124 being struck down, can you confirm there will be no moderation period for this sector?
The I don't know which home care provider you work for, but the for-profit home care providers were never covered by 124. If you're in a not-for-profit, like the VONs, then if you haven't had a moderation period, there shouldn't be one now.
Okay, Emily Gordon is asking, is there anything preventing the government from adding the notwithstanding clause for Bill 124 or bring forth a similar bill like 124 and adding that clause?
I can take this one. There is nothing legally preventing the government from enacting a similar bill or retabling Bill 124 with the use of the notwithstanding clause. What would prevent the government from doing that, as we have seen earlier this fall, is other forms of action by unions. And so I think that's not a legal question so much as to say that legally there's nothing preventing them from doing that.
It may be ruled on in the court of public opinion.
That's right.
Great, thank you. FC, what is ONA's plan with respect? Oh, the question just went away. I'll just see if I can bring it back here. Actually, the question has been removed, so I can't ask that one. And we have already answered this last question that is in the queue with regards to eligibility for retroactive pay. So we are at almost 6:25 here. So I'd like to launch a poll again. If you'll indulge us, we had a question from a member who asked us for a third option in our second poll. So the polling question is, given the current environment for nursing, do you intend to stay in nursing or leave the profession? Please press 1 for yes, I'll stay, 2 for no, I'm leaving nursing, and 3, 4, I'm unsure. 1, stay. 2, leave nursing. 3, unsure. Let's just give it a another minute here. So, for our callers on the line, 41% say they will stay, 21% say they feel like they're wanting to leave nursing, and 38% are unsure. So thank you for that. We have one final question in the queue. And that question is, does Bill 124 affect community health nurses? For example, myself in Parkdale, Queen West Community Health.
I would think so. Well, I would have. Doesn't, because it doesn't exist now.
Right.
The act affects any almost every publicly funded healthcare setting, because it
yes.
applies to any setting where there's where in 2018 there was over $1 million in public funding to the facility.
Right. And we have found the question that I was starting to read, so we'll just get an answer to that. Any other questions left in our queue will be on a Q&A on the ONA website from this call. So FC's question was, what is ONA's plan with respect to if Ford's appeal goes through, and how can we put more pressure on for what we want? What's the union steps and what's the legal team going to do? So from a leadership point of view, we will continue to pressure the government throughout this scenario as it unfolds. We have not stopped talking about their threats to appeal. We've asked them repeatedly not to do it. We'll see if it falls on deaf ears or not. But as far as our next legal options, maybe someone can talk about that.
Hi, folks. It's Jan. So if I understand the question correctly, it's if the government is appealed, and if at the Court of Appeal they're successful, the next legal step is then is to seek leave to appeal to the Supreme Court to have the case heard, which, referencing back to the case in Manitoba, when the nurses and other unions lost at the Court of Appeal, that's exactly what they did. And Danielle, maybe you can remind us of what the ultimate decision of the Court of Appeal was.
Yeah, the union sought leave to appeal in the Manitoba case, and the decision took an extraordinarily long time for the Supreme Court to issue, because I think they were waiting for the outcome of this case so that it would not influence this case one way or the other. And ultimately, the Supreme Court decided in October of this year to deny the Manitoba case leave to appeal. But that does not necessarily mean that they would do the same in these circumstances, and we'd have to assess and get instructions if there was an appeal beyond the Court of Appeal.
And it's just Sharon here. And just, you know, we are going to vigorously defend this decision. If the government intends to proceed with their appeal, we still don't have official documentation. So what we have is official public statements, but we will vigorously engage in arguments to protect the decision the best that we can as well. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Sharon, and our legal team. Thanks to Steve and everyone else on the call. Before we adjourn, I would just like to thank all of you for joining the town hall today. I also want to state in closing that this fight is not over if the government appeals the court's decision. I am very encouraged by your response to our first polling question, with the resounding 88% who are willing to do political action in the event of an appeal. That's outstanding. Thank you. I know many of you are beyond angry and frustrated that you have been disrespected and devalued by the Ford government, especially after all that you have gone through during this pandemic to care for Ontarians. I encourage you, keep sending in those emails to the government to amplify your voice. Please go to ona.org bill124 to send your message, and I encourage you to ask all of your contacts to do the same. We will continue to demand that the Ford government not appeal the court's decision. I'd like to thank everyone for attending tonight, and please have a safe and happy holiday season. We will post the follow-up Q&A on our website, and I am now adjourning the town hall. Thank you.